So that slows down for a few minutes. Barry, why don't you lead us in prayer since you've done so much good for us already?
Let's pray. Father in heaven, we are so thankful, Brother Jody, being here tonight and for us to try to learn about the early church. We pray that you would be with each one of us, that we could pay close attention to learn something tonight that we will help us on our way to heaven and help us to teach others. Thank you for all the folks that are here tonight. Continue to bless us as we try to live for you each day. And we pray that you would help us to bring someone to heaven with us. In Christ's name we pray.
Man. Okay. Yep, that works. Good evening.
Good evening.
Everybody have a good day? So far? Had a good day?
Every day.
Every day is a good day. That's good. Especially when you're what?
78.
Okay. It used to be a record number. 78? 33 zone. Old joke. This is the last session in church history, the first part of it, and we have noted a lot of things in the early classes that were pretty much things that we were on top of, that we understood, because they were based on Old Testament prophecies of the coming church, New Testament fulfillment of the church. And I mentioned this as we got outside of the realm of the first century, which means we're going past the writing of the book of Revelation, which is the dates of that vary, but usually no later than the middle of the ninth decade, so the mid-90s. So when you cross the 100 mark and you cross into the second century, things start to change. And we've looked at a lot of different names, a lot of different doctrines, a lot of different ideas that began to be digressions away from what we are familiar with in the pages in the New Testament. But we noted also that the digressions away from the New Testament are consistent in principle with some of the things that we see within the pages of the New Testament itself. There are examples in the pages of the New Testament of people binding where God didn't bind, or of loosing where God didn't loose. And so every error after that is going to be one of those two. Somebody adds something that God never said, or somebody takes away something that God did say, and they built a whole new doctrine on it. And over time, some of those things come together, collected, and you develop mindsets and attitudes and religious bodies that become more and more unlike what the original New Testament church was. There is a sense, however, that in spite of all the additions and or subtractions that creep in the coming centuries, the first few centuries, that there's still an adherence on the part of some people to seeing what the original text said. And so there's an emphasis on apostolic tradition, apostolic authority, and a lot of people wanted to remain rooted to that. Now, as we talk about some of the things today, if you have your books and you take a glance at it, and skipping what was presented in the seventh chapter because of the detail that was presented in it, and jumping into what we're going to see in the eighth and the ninth chapters, and we may not finish all of that, but the seventh chapter deals with some of the problems of the quote-unquote old Catholic Church, and I'm not going to deal with all of those things because there are a lot of names and a lot of controversies that are just, you know, it's more involved. But the eighth chapter deals with the life of Christianity in the second, third centuries. And it deals with how people became Christians. That's called Christian initiation, which references baptism. The assemblies, that is what they do when they gather together. How they lived, the role of women, and hope. And then the next one, chapter 9, which we'll get into some of anyway, deals with the development of persecution in the early church. So the principle that I mentioned before is additions and or subtractions that are going to increase in the second and third centuries. In principle, they were already there in the first century. Some people said you can't eat meat. Some people said you can't marry. Some people had other restrictions. Don't taste, don't touch, don't handle in the book of Colossians in the second chapter. And all of those were things that people added to what the Bible said. When Jesus, in his own ministry, was dealing with the religious leaders, Jesus had said that they had made the traditions that they upheld more important than God's traditions. Well, where'd that come from? It came from a long history of Judaism moving ever so slowly over a period of time away from the truth. so that when you look at the practices of the children of Israel in the centuries after the Mosaic Law was given, they had deviated from the law. They started doing things that the law never said. Where in the law did it ever say you should worship the brass serpent that was held up as a means of being forgiven, so to speak, of the invasion of serpents that God sent in one of the plagues? Nowhere. But during the latter times, they began to worship that. God never said to do that. Where did the idea that the Samaritan woman and her ancestors get the idea that they should ever worship in Mount Gerizim? God never said that. God said, "Behold, I set before you this day a blessing and a curse, and it's as obvious as this mountain, Mount Gerizim, which is the mount of blessing, and Mount Ebal, which is the mount of cursing." So people said, "Hey, if it's a mount of blessing, ought to be a good place to worship God." So that's all the reason you need. God never commanded that. And so that same sort of stuff is going to develop as we go further into the churches in the second and third centuries. So let's talk about some of these sources that we've alluded to before, but I don't want to focus so much on the sources as much as the teachings that relate to what the early church did. So the teaching of the 12, which is often referred to as the Didache, came out in the first 50 years after the close of the New Testament canon. Tertullian and others that we're going to mention by name are part of those folks that are known as the church fathers. And so sometimes they're referred to as the patristics, that is the writings from the Latin form for pater, father. They were people in some cases who were associated with the apostles. Polycarp was said to have known the apostle John. He's martyred. He was killed for his death and for his Christianity, burned at the stake in about the middle of the second century when he's 80 some years old. And there's good evidence that he actually knew the apostle John. So a lot of these folks that we're talking about knew some of the original apostles. And so, but you're going to get moving away from that. So there are some adherence to apostolic authority and some things that are going to become slowly but surely, by accretion, they start moving away from things that are going on in the New Testament church. So notice some of the things that we're going to talk about. One, preparation for baptism. There was, does anybody know what catechism means? All right. If you come from a Roman Catholic background, I came from a Lutheran background when I was a child, and I, in my teen years in 7th, 8th grade, went through catechism for 2 years after school every day during the course of the year. And that's a biblical word, but it has been adopted in a non-biblical way. Let me get you to look in your Bibles to the book of Luke in the first chapter. So if you're looking in Luke chapter 1, Luke is writing to Theophilus, a man whose name means lover of good. And he says, "I'm going to write to you about things that we believe, and I'm going to set these things in order so you have some certitude about your faith." So that's just a quick snapshot of what he says in the first four verses. So he says, "I'm going to tell you about the things that were revealed to me by the eyewitnesses." So Luke wasn't an eyewitness. "Write these things down. I've had perfect understanding. And I write an orderly account." Now watch what he says, "that you may know the certainty." That's a pretty powerful word. "Of those things in which you were," watch this, "instructed." The original term for the term instructed is the word from which we get catechism. It simply means an orderly means of instruction. That's all. But catechism developed into this mindset that some people could not be baptized unless they'd gone through 3 years of study. Now, if I made that rule today, what would you think? Something's wrong with you, boy. All right? Well, where did that come from? It came from a mindset that they wanted to make sure that people were really doing this because they wanted to do it and knew what they were getting into. Let's look at the other side of the coin. Do you know of, and we don't need to get into the stories about this, do you know of people who rushed into baptism didn't know what in the world they were doing? Oh yeah, that happens. How can that be? Too young, not taught, mom and daddy pushed it into it. You can think of lots of different reasons why somebody might be encouraged to be baptized and they didn't really know what they were doing. One occasion of studying with a young lady, her mother was very concerned that the daughter wasn't baptized. She was in her early teens, as I recall. And we started studying with the young lady, and when we'd ask her questions, Mama would always answer. And at one point I said, "Can you let your daughter answer the questions?" mama's faith was standing in the place of the little girl's faith. That's something that's going to come up in the context of who can be baptized in the early church. Some people are afraid the infant mortality rate in the early days of Christianity, not because of the early days of Christianity, just because of what the nature of the culture was very, very high. And so some people understanding the essentiality of baptism would fear that their children would be lost because they never got old enough to be baptized. And slowly but surely, people started baptizing infants. So you've got two spectrums here. Baptize anybody just in case, and you can't be baptized unless you go through this catechetical process of almost 3 years of training. And so that's two totally different perspectives about who could be baptized. In the context of the New Testament, on the day of Pentecost, how long did Peter speak? I have no idea. The Bible says, with many other words, did he testify and exhort, saying, save yourselves or be saved from this crooked or perverse generation. So how much time did he speak on that day? I don't know. Who else spoke on that day? Well, he stood up with the 11. And when the people responded, they said to Peter and the rest of the apostles, and then they continued steadfastly in the apostles' doctrine. Four times in that chapter, it makes reference to the apostles being there, indicating that they had something to say as well, and none of that's recorded. So how long did they take on the day of Pentecost to teach those people? Again, I don't know. In the book of Nehemiah in chapter 8, when the restoration of the kingdom was going on after Judah came out of Babylonian captivity, Ezra the priest stood and read the Old Testament book of the law, most likely the book of Deuteronomy, from early in the morning until noon, and all the people stood and listened. Well, did it take 3 hours of preaching on the day of Pentecost for those people to be convinced? You know, I can read the account that's brought out in the book of Acts in a matter of minutes. I don't know that Peter went through that in a matter of minutes, especially since it says he had many other words. So this is one extreme that people had. The other thing is, they developed the idea that baptism had to be done at a designated time, not in the immediacy of the moment. When Stephen, after the death of Stephen, and the church began to spread, and Philip went to the city of Samaria, it said, you know, people heard him preaching about the kingdom of God and so forth and about Jesus, and it says they were baptized. And then the man that was formerly known as Simon the sorcerer, he heard that, he was baptized. No designated day, something about the immediacy of the moment. And then when he goes on the way and he's led by the angel and the spirit to connect with the Ethiopian eunuch as they're walking, going along in the chariot, see, here's water, what keeps me from being baptized? No planning. It was done then, there. Philippian jailer, same hour of the night. So they developed this idea that baptism had to have a huge amount of preparation, and that could only be done at designated times, and the preferable time was on the day that was assumed to be the resurrection day, or Easter Sunday. And so that developed over time. None of that's in the biblical text. But this happened within the centuries immediately after the close of the New Testament canon. And so these are ideas that you can see, well, they're intended to do good. Yeah, I've got that. But they're changing the text enough that the specific practices aren't identical. I have been in different religious groups' buildings and have seen a schedule of baptisms. No names, it's just here are the pre-described dates that we're going to baptize people. And if you want to be baptized, you know, you put your name in for one of those dates. All right? I called about a training class in Lumpkin County, and they do it on a certain quarter, and the next class was full, so I had to wait for the next class. So it's scheduled. So you schedule baptisms. Again, there's nothing in the biblical text about that. The other thing was, in addition to up to 3 years of catechetical training, that you went through a series of confessions. And sometimes they baptized three people in the name of the Father, Son, and the Spirit. Usually it was done by immersion. And usually when they did large groups of baptism, they did men first, and then women, and then children. And everybody was baptized with no clothes on. I don't think we'd let that go on in Congregation of the Lord's Church today. So where did all this stuff came from? Some of it came from a mindset that was mistaken about things that were going on in the general religious pagan world in Greek and Roman mythology and so forth. And so, and then initially after that, They would anoint the people with oil, and they would immediately have the Lord's Supper, commonly referred to as the Eucharist, and also give them water, milk, and honey. And so all of these things were additions to what was going on in the New Testament church. You don't see any of those practices there, but yet these are things that developed. So the other thing was that, generally speaking, there was an adherence to the biblical practice of baptizing by immersion. But there developed the understanding, thank you, sir, there developed the understanding that in exceptional cases, we need to do exceptional things, and exceptional things would allow that you could sprinkle and or pour somebody, especially in the case of infants, and especially in the case of quote-unquote deathbed conversions. Now that became a controversy. Just because somebody started it didn't mean everybody accepted it. And so if somebody survived on the other side of a quote-unquote deathbed conversion, some people said, now you got to be baptized the right way. All right, so even though there were a lot of accepted cases, people were concerned about that. So the baptism of children, it says, mainly in the case of necessity, and that's where they assumed the child was going to die. And again, I mentioned before that infant mortality rates were high in those days, and so a lot of people started baptizing children. And some of that is a kind of just-in-case sort of thing. And so early on, there's a slight departure in different ways. Timing of baptism, overly teaching baptism, exceptions to what the Bible said from the standpoint of the mode of baptism and so forth. All of these things are creeping into the early church, and it doesn't completely go away. And once one bad idea takes hold in one area, it kind of spreads, right? And this is one of the things that people are concerned about in the general religious world today. You start listening to all kinds of people who aren't rooted in the New Testament authority, and you may end up being, you know, totally different in what it is that you're going to believe and practice. All right, so let's talk about the assemblies of the Lord's Church. We see assemblies in the Lord's Church discussed in many of Paul's letters. We don't have an exact, complete, blow-by-blow description of every last thing that takes place in the assembly, but there's a general picture that's given in the different avenues of worship that we often address. So what was going on in some of these early centuries? Generally speaking, the worship services occurred on the Lord's Day, and they almost always occurred way early in the day before sunrise. Why was that? Well, one reason was, from our perspective, Sunday is the first day of the week. In our perspective, Sunday is a weekend. No concept of weekend holiday sort of stuff that existed in those days. Most people were working on Sunday. It was another day of the week. It wasn't a day off. All right. We think exclusively of Sunday, the Lord's Day, the first day of the week. But in the Roman Empire in those days, it wasn't given to be a weekend or a holiday. And that was the day people worked. And so if you're going to go to work that day and you're going to worship that day, they would often meet very, very, very early in the morning, which looked like they were doing things in secret. And that's one of the things that some people said about these Christians. They're kind of strange. They meet in secret by themselves way early in the morning. And we hear that they eat the body and drink the blood. And so some people, you know, attributed them to be practitioners of cannibalism. Well, you think, well, that's a goofy thing. Well, if you don't know enough and you hear that, you know, hey, did you hear what those people are doing? You know? And so there's the legitimate practice of assembling on the Lord's Day and doing what God wanted them to do. It's easy for people to take that out of hand. Jesus on one occasion said that he's going to destroy the temple and raise it up in 3 days. Only in the context, Jesus was speaking about his physical body. And some people who heard that said, he said he's going to destroy it, and they point to Herod's temple and build it back up in 3 days. Wait a minute. Jesus said what you think he said, but he didn't mean what you think he meant. All right? And so we need to get that sort of stuff straight. So early accounts are presented by some people who are Christians. Incidentally, the writings of the New Testament were adhered to very strenuously, but the whole idea of having commentaries and other people kind of doing, you know, running commentary on stuff and radio and television preaching, that kind of stuff, of course, didn't exist then. That's going to develop later. And once you see a school of apologists and philosophers that begin to grow, who become people who are defenders of Christianity. So there was no defender of Christianity in any official ones presented in the close of the apostolic period of time. There was no kind of tribunal, no kind of creeds or catechism set up to protect the faith. But slowly but surely, people develop the idea, hey, you people are attacking what we believe, and we're going to speak in defense of it. Okay, that's okay. But some of those people who were defending the truth weren't as well grounded in the truth as they needed to be. And because of that, you had some more problems that are going to develop in the early church. Not everybody's that way. And so some of these early writers, who are often called apologists, were writing to ground people in the faith who were already on the inside of the faith. And some of them were writing to reach those people who were critical of the faith on the outside. So you began to develop a body of writing on a larger scale, more than just the New Testament documents, and that's going to come out as we go a little bit further. So Christians were assembling, notice, by the end of the 3rd century. So this is in the late 200s. Instruction of the word open to all, Lord's Supper for the baptized only. So somewhere the idea developed that anybody and everybody could come and hear the preaching of the word. But when it came to observing what was referred to as the Eucharist, the Lord's Supper, the communion, you couldn't be even in the room, let alone being able to participate in it. Years and years ago, we lived in a community in Tennessee near Cookeville. And there was a congregation that was known as the Free Communion Church of Christ. And the first time I heard that, I thought, that's weird. Nobody charges anywhere for the communion. And then I realized that was the name of the community. The name of the community was Free Communion. And so the name of the Lord's Church was called the Free. It just sounded different. Well, some people have been very rigorous about that, seriously. And if there was somebody in the midst of a congregation they knew that wasn't a member of the church, they would do whatever they could to keep them from observing the communion. Why? Well, you're not qualified. Well, yeah, I got that. There, to them, it would have been nothing more than consuming physical elements. It would have been the exact memorial. But some people are very persnickety about that and wouldn't have them do that. Well, they would actually separate the services so that some people who were present for the preaching and teaching could not be present for the observance of the Lord's Supper. Is there a biblical mandate for that? I don't see it. One thing is, the assemblies of the Lord's Church on the first day of the week were for the Christians and were not used exclusively as an opportunity to evangelize the world. That's what people did when they weren't meeting together. And so the mindset of using worship services on Sunday to be an evangelistic opportunity, that wasn't intrinsic to the early church, and that's going to develop over time. And sad to say, that's almost the only way some people do evangelism today, is assuming that somebody's going to walk in our doors to hear the gospel. And I'm not saying that's impossible, but there's a mindset that developed that did not exist in the early church. All right, so one of the things that they did, the very bottom thing, some of the apologists, these are the people who begin defending the faith, either to those who have issues inside that might have been heretical or those who are on the outside and don't understand it. Some of those folks developed a hierarchy in and of themselves in which they became authorities that were on par with the apostles. And so as we get into the rest of this section, and especially the next one, development of Christianity in the next few centuries, some of those folks ran for office, so to speak, when they were wanting to become presbyters or bishops or so forth. They were actually elected, and there was campaigning that went on. All of that's going to be spawned from what we see here. Some of these pictures that are in the text just show ancient pictures of people worshiping in various places. One of the things that the regular life of Christianity was involved in that was very distinct, Galen, who was a very secular philosopher of the day, was impressed by the purity in the lives of the early church. This is touchy ground, but it's worthy of discussing. When you think about a religious group that's known for abstaining in what most other people involved in, sexual sins and eating certain foods and whatever, who do you think of? All right, Catholics could be? Seventh-day Adventists, Mormons. Those people have developed a reputation in part, maybe not as well known today as people are more secular than religious today, for some of the things that they abstain from. Well, in the early days of the church, Christians were noted for not getting involved in all the stuff that everybody in the pagan world got involved in. They didn't eat stuff that was sold in the marketplaces sometimes because they were afraid it was offered to idols and they didn't want to violate a conscience. They didn't bow down to worship the emperor. They wouldn't pay tribute to anything that was pagan. They didn't involve them in sexual immorality and so forth. And so they were kind of odd men out from the way the rest of the world looked at that. And that, those were some of the things that people would talk to people about before they became Christians, and says, if you're living in this relationship, you can't. If you're not married to this woman, you need to marry this woman. Not married to this man, you need to marry them, so forth. So there's a big deal about the morality of the early church. And that needs to be a big deal today as well. Yes, sir. Yeah. Yeah. They did that in the early days, but it wasn't straight wine. It was always mixed with water. And so that's one of the things that they were concerned about. This is not... interesting, except from one perspective. When I was a young man many, many years ago and lived in Colorado, went to school there, they sold what they called 3-2 beer. Anybody know what that is?
Military used to have it from the bases.
Okay. The normal alcohol content of those beers was double that. And so if you were 18, you could buy 3-2 beer, which was half the alcoholic content. So if you're a smart 18-year-old and you're only allowed to drink beer that's half the alcoholic content, what are you going to do?
Drink twice as much.
Yeah. To me, it was an advertising gimmick for the beer companies to sell more beer. That didn't make a lick of sense to me, and I wasn't a Christian at the time. But the point is, it was watered down, and so they dropped the alcohol content by the way they made it. And so they did use wine mixed with water in many of the Lord's Supper observances because that's what they had. And so that's part of what some of them did. But there's an emphasis on all of these things that focus on morality. They discourage people from being involved in the military. They discourage people from making any kind of pledge that would show allegiance to any kind of false system of worship. That was part of what was going on in the Roman Empire. And if you were in the military service, they'd encourage you to take a pledge not to be willing to kill anybody. A lot of the military service that was going on, and this is very broad, were civil order and also engineering things, road building. So a lot of people could be in the service and not have any part of anything that would be questionable. There's an emphasis on the place of women in culture then, but also in Christianity, about being wives and mothers. There developed a group of women who were known for their faith, that were martyrs, that were of some regard, and so forth. There was an emphasis on asceticism, monasticism, staying away from things in the world, and so forth. And then there was some of those people who were referred to as deaconesses. Incidentally, Phoebe's referred to with that title in the book of Romans 16. But it's not kind of an official title. It's more of a designation of her service than anything else. And there was still respect for female leadership being limited in that time. One of the things that was very much representative of Christian faith in those days was a hope that they had that was transcendent to the world in which they lived. One of the reasons why the church grew so rapidly in the second and third centuries was there was a general attitude about culture across the Roman Empire that was very, very negative. And the hope that Christians had appealed to people. You know, the world's going down the tubes very quickly. These people act like there's a real hope. You know, maybe there's something to what they have. It's part of what Peter says when people have a question of the hope that lies within you, give them an answer. How can you have that hope in the midst of persecution? Some of that, if we get further into the next chapter, we'll deal with persecution that existed in the early church. Their eschatology. Eschatology refers to things that are going to happen at the end of time. Everything in the New Testament church and the New Testament faith is done in an immediate, present tense way of living in view of something to come in the future. There's always an end time focus on the way we live. We live this way because it's good to live this way, but we're living this way not only because it's good to live this way, because there's a benefit to it down the road. And so we're sowing the seeds of something greater than what we're doing in the immediate present. There's something to come. Now there's a big 50-cent word here, kiliastic. Anybody know what that means? Well, have you heard of the word millennium? Have you heard a group of youngsters referred to as millennials? M-I-L-L comes from a Latin form for thousand. And so millennialism deals with the idea of a thousand-year reign. Kiliastic stuff, kiliism, is the same thing, only it's from a Greek origin as opposed to Latin. So they did not have a millennial theology, is what they're saying. They believed that they were living in the midst of a millennium then, not that it was going to be a literal 1,000-year reign. So this is long, long, long before Scofield Reference Bible and all those folks that got involved in that in the late 1800s, John Darby and so forth, that were involved in millennial theory. But there was a practical aspect of living faithfully then and there before the Lord came. So they focused on the future heavenly reign of the earth, and there was some discussion about that as well, and focusing on the reality of the bodily resurrection that was going to come. All right, so these are some of the things that drove what Christians were involved in those days. Let me move to the second lesson. Let's see here. I didn't open the second one. Let's see, is that just going to open? There we go. So I want to get into the next chapter, and then we're going to do something different when we get that finished. Aha, we did it. Woohoo! All right. Gotta hold this down and drop over here. All right, so this is the next chapter. I mentioned before we skipped the seventh chapter because it was bogged down a lot of details. I'm not saying it's not important. So we went through the eighth chapter, it was rather short. Now we're dealing with the ninth chapter. And this is the church in the third century. So the first century is 0 to 99, or 0 to 100. And 101 to 199 is the second. You cross over 200, and now you're getting into the third century. So this is 110, 120 years after the close of the writing of the New Testament. So what has happened in the century or so since the New Testament has closed? That's part of what we're going to talk about here. And we're going to see some interesting things that happened because of persecution. Persecution occurred in the days of the first century church. Where did most of the persecution start from originally in the pages of the New Testament?
Jews.
Started from Judaism. Where did that come from? Well, Jesus experienced that antagonism and that challenge repeatedly. How many times does somebody come to Jesus and he's described as a lawyer? And the word lawyer there meant a doctor of the law of Moses, not lawyer in the sense of legal profession. And it came to him testing him. See that language all the time, came testing him. And so the Pharisees would test Jesus, the Sadducees would test Jesus, others would test Jesus. So there's an antagonistic thing going on there. Well, what were all these people worried about this guy who came from Nazareth, which they despised because it was in Galilee, did not realize all the time that he was born in Bethlehem in Judea. Why was so much antagonism? Well, he challenged the way they thought. He challenged the way they taught. He challenged their authority. And because of that, he kind of rocked the boat. Now, he didn't come to be a troublemaker, but that's the way he was viewed. He associates with publicans and sinners. This woman was caught in the middle of adultery, you know, he kind of stood up for her. He goes to this guy, Zacchaeus' house, and everybody knows that the publicans take advantage working for the Romans, they add extra taxes on. He just hangs around with people that we don't like. And so he didn't have the best of reputations. And so the early church is going to develop an attitude, toward that in part is due to the original attitude that was developed by the Jews who were antagonistic to Jesus towards his church. And so for a long time, Jewish and Christian folks were all assumed to be just different people in the same kind of house. And so when the Jews were kicked out of the city of Rome, Priscilla and Aquila were kicked out of the city of Rome. Why? They were Christians, but they were Jews first. And so all the folks who became Christians on the day of Pentecost, who were they? Jews. Where were they? Scattered throughout the empire. And so all the different places that's mentioned in Acts chapter 2 from whence they had come, those are all Jews who lived in those places, who came from other places that were in the empire to be there that day. So for a long time, Christianity was a set, small subset of the Jews. But over a period of time, the Jews got wise to the methodology of evangelism. What did Paul often do when he'd go to a new community? What opportunity did he take to teach souls first? Often he went to the synagogue. Why? He was schooled at Gamaliel, one of the leading religious leaders of the day. He was very well educated. He knew the law backwards and forwards concerning, you know, those who are faithful to the law. Paul said, you couldn't find anybody more faithful to the law than I was. I mean, he was so zealous to the law, he was persecuting those Christians and see to it that they were punished and some of them were killed. He was consenting to the death of Stephen. And when you read Acts chapter 23 in his defense before the Sanhedrin, he allowed that he was also responsible for the death of other people. So come on in, Mr. Paul. What do you have to say? Well, he would start with the Old Testament. And he'd end up saying Jesus is the Christ. And say, wait a minute. We didn't think you were going to do that. So over a period of time, the Jews would stop letting Christians come in and using that as an opportunity to preach and teach the gospel. So over a period of time, the Christians became understood as being distinct from the Jews. And sometimes even the Jews would say, hey, those are those troublemakers. They don't worship Caesar. Well, neither do you. But it was easy for them to say that to get those folks in trouble. And so during the reign of Nero, Christianity suffered some sporadic persecution. During the reign of Domitian, they suffered some sporadic persecution. During the reign of Trajan, in the opening of the second century, in the early 100s, Pliny would write to them. He was a governor in one area. He says, hey, we've got these people here who follow this man by the name of Crestus, C-H-R-E-S-T-U-S, which is the way they would have written Christ in Latin. And what do we do with them? He says, well, if they're not causing any trouble and if they're willing to, you know, pay homage to the Caesars, don't do anything. So what if they don't? He says, well, then weigh it on a case-by-case basis. If they're old and they're feeble, don't do anything. But if necessary, you punish them. And so he was given permission to punish these people, not because of what they believed as much as by what they refused to do because of what they didn't believe. They didn't believe you could pay homage to Caesar. And that got them in trouble. Do you remember Mordecai? Book of Esther. What got Mordecai in trouble from the standpoint of Haman? Haman was second in command, and Mordecai refused to pay homage to him. And that just ticked the boy off. And he says, I'll fix him. I'll kill all the Jews, and that way I'll get rid of him too. Now, that all fell on Haman later when the plot against the Jews was uncovered because of Esther's role. So persecution is going to begin to develop. And it's going to really kick in the middle of the third century. So this is about 240 to 250. It was short-lived, but it got to the point they started going after officials in the Roman Empire who were connected with the church. If you read through Paul's letter to the church at Rome, he makes reference to people who are Christians who are in Caesar's household. That doesn't mean they were part of the family, but they could have been servants or workers or something like that. The estimation is by the time that the first century closed, which is 95 to 100 AD, that 10% of the population of the city of Rome had some connection to the church. There was 1 million people there. Now that's estimates. You know, the Bible doesn't say that. But the church grew so much that they were the object of persecution. And then when there was official edicts not to persecute them anymore, the edict of toleration, and then when they became the official quote-unquote state religion, it's going to grow by like wildfire. But then it's not exactly the same church that it was in the close of the New Testament. So all of these things are going on. So they would go after clergy. They would confiscate their buildings. They would confiscate their property, would confiscate their money. And somebody had asked the thing before about property. In one of the sections, I think, is in this chapter, Brother Ferguson notes that church ownership of property is going to kick in the later second and third centuries. And so, you know, that's what's going to happen. These people are going to be persecuted. There are limited bouts of persecution during the first century in which Nero would take some of his opponents and literally light them on fire to light the games in the city of Rome. And that not only happened there, but elsewhere. What's really interesting is at the close of the first century during the writing of the book of Revelation, persecution was more intense in Asia Minor than anywhere else. It's because some of those folks in Asia Minor, where all the seven churches were, ESP, TSP, L, that you see in second and third chapters of Revelation, they were more gung-ho for emperor worship than even the people in Rome were. There were over 240 statues to Augustus, all right, the nephew of Julius Caesar, considered the first of the Roman emperors in the series of 12, in Asia Minor alone. Well, what do you have all those statues and idols to him for? Because people were expected to bow down and worship it. And when you didn't, you got into trouble. And Christians didn't, and they got into trouble. And so Antipas is referred to as a martyr, one who died for his faith in the book of Revelation, the second chapter. He says, and others will die. In Revelation chapter 5, the souls that are under the altar cry out saying, "How long, Lord?" He says, "Other people will die too." And so in the latter part of the first century, Christians were dying not because of worldwide persecution, but because of limited persecution in that part of Asia Minor. And that's what prompted the book of Revelation. That's what it prompted it, and that's why it was written in the unique language it was written in, so not everybody's going to know what's going on. Very, very highly figurative and apocalyptic language. This is interesting. Because of this idea that it was good to die for your faith. Remember, the word martyr just means witness. Martyr doesn't mean that you've died. The word martyria in the New Testament is used about providing testimony, a witness. But it came to be used exclusively in reference to those who died for their faith. And there was a mindset that kind of crept into Christianity, or Christianity so-called, that came from ancient cultures in which dead heroes took on power. There are some societies, usually far eastern societies, in which there's a very, very over-the-top, more than healthy veneration for ancestors, in which people practically worship their ancestors. Well, that's nothing new. That's been going on for a long time. And so somebody who died in a cultic practice of some kind in pagan culture, Greek and Roman mythology, if they died as a hero, people looked to them as a hero not only before their death, but after their death. And so over a period of time, people began to develop that kind of attitude about those people who died for the faith. And they became known as saints in a special way. Now, he notes that the Latin term sancti, which is the translation of the Greek hagios, which means holy, separated one, it was still used to refer to all those who were Christians, but it came to be developed in a special sense to those who died for their faith, who were venerated after the fact. And so you see a concept of saint worship, not everyday Christian saint worship, starting in the early centuries. Well, why? Respect for the dead, respect to the dead who died for a good cause, but this kind of thinking, they're in the presence of Jesus now. We know somebody who, when they were alive, knew us, and they're in the presence of Jesus now. They're closer to Jesus than we are. Let's see if they can come to our aid. You might say, well, that's kind of innocent. It is. It's also kind of naive, assuming that that could happen. Now, let me just mention, and this is not to go too far with this, in Luke chapter 16, when it talks about Lazarus and the rich man, there's a gulf fixed between those. And the assumption is the only way we know what's going on is that it's being able to be revealed to us by means of revelation. But there's no sense, there's nothing that says there wasn't a gulf fixed between the dead and the living. There's a gulf fixed between Lazarus and the rich man, but there's another gulf that's there that's only bridged because of the account that's given in that setting. And the point is, there's nothing that says people who've died can do anything for you after the fact. In fact, the book of 2 Corinthians says that you have nothing on the other side of death that can be done for you, not by you or anybody else. Now, the understanding that the Mormons have of 1 Corinthians 15:29 about those who are baptized for the dead, that's talking about assuming that Jesus died and was not resurrected, because they denied resurrection generally. They said, why would you be baptized in the name of a dead person who could never rise again? And so that's not talking about being baptized on the surface for somebody who is dead, and you can do something after the fact. That's total misinterpretation of that passage. But anyway, this developed in the early church. Where did it come from? Respect for people who died for their faith, and a little bit too much respect. So they would pay homage to their relatives on certain days, their birthdays, or they would give them a new birthday in which they transcended from this life into the next life, and that's the day that they were born into heaven, you know, because they reached their goal. So some of those things could have started innocently, but they kept going on. And one of the things that was very common would be to pray in the context of worship service using them, and even pray in the context of wherever it was that they were buried. So these things took on life of their own and expanded. In a few centuries, it's going to be very big. And now, you know, part of the canonization process that's unique to the Roman Catholic Church is that they venerate these people and officially designate them as saints who can become some sort of intercessor between us and the Christ and the Father that never existed in New Testament times whatsoever. This is the precursor of that. There's no Catholic Church yet. There's no Pope in the sense that we think of it yet. That's going down the road. But those things starting incrementally. It didn't say all of a sudden, close of day, you know, 365 at the end of this year and 160 on the first day of the next year, the whole thing's going to exist full blown. No, it happens incrementally. All right, and so that's some of the things that are going to happen. So this is what, imagine you were a faithful Christian living in those days, and you really said, hey, we need to go by what the apostles said, and that's it. And there's nothing in the apostolic authority that says you can do this. Well, here's another issue. For a while, people were of the mindset that there was some sense of inherent authority in those who die for their faith, and people would appeal to them. But here you've got a bunch of people appealing to the authority of dead people, and you've got religious leaders who are saying, hey, don't listen to dead people, listen to us. Well, who is that? That's those folks who assume that they were elders, bishops, and presbyters in a way unlike what you see in the New Testament. They said, we're the ones who are the successors of the apostles. Those people aren't successors of the apostles. They just happen to die for their faith. And so there's a challenge from the standpoint of who held authority in the early church based upon whether or not you should worship somebody or venerate somebody who had died for their faith, regardless of what they were in the church, and the bishop saying, hey, I'm alive. I'm the bishop of such and such church in such and such place. You listen to me. Don't go petition the dead people. So it's kind of odd having a debate about listen to me, not the dead people. But that's kind of what was going on in these in this section of time. So this is one of the individuals who developed a very popular, he was beheaded for his faith eventually. He was born into a pagan, very rich family, and became a Christian, I think it was in his 30s, from what we understand, and I'm using the word Christian loosely there. But he was a leader in the church in Carthage in North Africa, and he got himself involved in all sorts of controversies. Now, I'm not gonna go through all of this, but one of the things that's very interesting that we know so much about him was the guy wrote constantly. Lots and lots and lots of letters that he wrote still exist. And lots of letters that were written to him still exist. And so there's a huge body of literature that Mr. Cyprian, and that's not his full name, it's a much longer term, that he was involved in. That body of literature still exists. So this is why we can know so much about him. Well, there were some controversies that developed that he weighed in on that in the next few minutes before we take a break, I want to say something about, and that's this. In the midst of the persecution, and he died in the midst of the persecution, notice he died in 258, so persecution is going on in the middle of the 3rd century. There was an issue about what you would do if somebody lapsed in their faith. So here's what was done. If you don't offer sacrifices to the Roman gods or to the Roman emperors, you could be persecuted, you could be prosecuted, you could be killed. And so they sold, this is not the indulgences that came to come into play in the Catholic Church many years later that Luther rebelled against 500 years ago this year, by the way. The last day of the month was the day that he tacked the 95 Theses up, so that 500th year is 2 days from today. And so that's a big deal in quote-unquote Reformation history. Long before that, all right, so that's 500 years ago. This is long before that. There was an idea that if you don't want to be persecuted by the Roman Empire, you have to pay a fee to have a permission that you don't have to do this. We're going to get money out of you somehow. And so some of those people would pay a fee to be exempted from these things were considered to have lapsed in their faith. And so one of the debates that took place in the early church is, what do you do with people who either sacrifice the idols and just jump wholesale into submitting to the Roman authority, or who kind of buy the script to get exempted for, or they would have somebody in their household, like a slave or a servant, go and offer the sacrifice for them, so they didn't do it themselves. You know, they had somebody do it by proxy. Well, that was a debate in the early church. And so Novatian, who was a quote-unquote bishop in Rome, was known as a rigorist. He said, there's no way back for those people ever, ever, ever. You've done that, you can never be reaccepted as a faithful child of God. Cyprian was on the other side. And the lapsus, who thought, you know, don't worry about that, it's going to be okay. Well, he was kind of in the middle. He was opposite of Novatian, but he wasn't saying let anybody back. He said, no, those people have to do some kind of penance. They may never be fully accepted to the church, but they have to do penance from now until the day they die. And when they die, they can go into heaven. All right? So this is one of the doctrines that he got involved in, is the issue, the controversy, and here's the Latin term, those who had lapsed. Should we ever accept him back? All right? You read the Corinthian epistle, 1 Corinthians 5, there's a man who's involved in a relationship with his father's wife. And say it was his mother, so it could have been a second marriage. And Paul says, people in the world don't even do that. So you treat that person like he's not even a child of God. Don't have anything to do with him. So he said, deliver such a one to Satan for the destruction of the flesh. Now he didn't mean to kill him, but destruction of the fleshly tendencies. So when Paul wrote to the church the second time, the second Corinthian epistle, what did he tell him to do? Guys repented, take him back in and treat him like a brother. Well, some of these folks that were involved in that said, no way, the guy's been involved in such an egregious sin to offer sacrifices for pagan idols. Don't ever accept that guy back. Can't be done. So Cyprian weighed in on that. So this is part of the stuff that's going on in the days of the early church. How do you deal with people who have some degree of lapsing or falling away, backslider, so to speak, who under threat of penalty or death or punishment are going to say, okay, I give in, I'll pay the fine, or I'll offer the sacrifice to the pagan deities. So those were issues that came up. So notice they emphasize penance. This is a precursor of what's going to be done later when some people would sell the right indulgences. If you pay us X amount of money, if you go into purgatory, you won't be there as long because you paid this kind of money. And so the whole sale of indulgences that's going to develop later is rooted kind of in this stuff. Only it wasn't the church that was doing it. It was the Roman Empire. So here's what's interesting that's going to develop over the next few centuries. The organization of what came to be the Roman Catholic Church is imitating a lot of the structure and the hierarchy of the Roman Empire. So central figure, the emperor, and then you've got all the college, the cardinals, and all the other stuff, and bishops and so forth. And so, you know, that's a very well-known thing, and that's not denied by the Catholic Church, is that they borrow the hierarchy of their system in part from what was going on in Imperial Rome. So Imperial Rome is not intending to become the precursor of the Catholic Church when they're doing this. That's not it at all. They just, you're an atheist, you don't worship our gods, we're going to punish you. So they're doing it for a secular reason, more so than a religious reason. Because it wasn't a church. The Roman Empire wasn't a church. That's the cult of the Roman Empire. And so there's no church, it's just part of pagan religion. Everybody venerates their gods, and we have made our emperors our gods. You venerate the gods. All right, so everybody's gods. I think I mentioned this before. When Paul came to the city of Athens, he said, you're so superstitious. There were alleged to have been no more than 20,000 people in the city of Athens at the time that Paul was there, which meant it was on the downward side of what had been when it was a great city-state many, many years before. But the estimate is there were more than 30,000 idols all over the city. And so the jokesters and the pundits of the day said it was easier to find a god in the city of Athens than a human being, because they turned everything into a god. And there was literally a god that was known as the unknown god that they assumed had delivered them from disaster before. And Paul used that and said, let me tell you about the real god you don't know, and started talking about the real true god. So this is part of what's going on in the development of the early church. Now, it's not identical to what we have on the religious world today. But you can see how what we have today is just, you know, orders of magnitude, you know, above that. No religious denominations existed then. They're all claiming to be part of the church. They're deviating stuff. So there's no Baptist church, no Methodist church, no Presbyterian church, no Lutheran church, no Knox, no Calvin, no Zwingli, no Ulrich. None of those guys, Ulrich Zwingli. None of those things even existed. But the problems that are going to develop by the time we get to the Reformation, they're already there. And again, the root problems that we see here, we see examples of them, not to the same scale and the same issues, but the same kind of things, binding where God hasn't bound or loosing where God hasn't loosed. That's already in play in the New Testament time. All right, so this is the other guy who was the bishop in Rome who said, no, I'm a rigorist. Those guys can never, ever come back. All right, so this was an issue then. Well, if somebody's been involved in that, can we just baptize them all over again? Somebody says, nope, you sin this, that's it, you're done. You sin once, we're going to write you off to a devil's hell. And so that was an issue. Can you be rebaptized? The example of the Ephesians, the disciples that Paul encountered in the book of Acts in the 19th chapter, they were baptized, but it was John's baptism, which was valid at the time that they were baptized with John, or it was still in effect at one point, but something changed, and that's the Christ had come. And so it was valid at one point, but they didn't know anything about the coming of the Christ, so they missed something. So there was an issue about baptism, whether or not that could be done. And the other issue was that developed was, what about the qualifications of the person who baptized you? What if something wasn't right there? Is your baptism valid? So Paul raises that question in the Corinthian epistle. It said, if his works are burned, nevertheless, his righteousness still stands. The point is, if somebody falls away that I've taught, it's not because I've done anything wrong. Well, the reverse of that's also the case. You know, is your faithfulness dependent on the faithfulness of the person who baptized you? If that's the case, that's a scary situation. And so they said, no, don't worry about that. Said, baptism won't do any good if those people are baptized by the wrong people. So here is another issue that creeps into play. Said, well, if baptism doesn't do any good, then the laying on of hands by the presbytery or bishop can sanctify them. Then the other issue is, what if you're baptized for the wrong reason or the wrong way? And again, they said the imposition of a bishop's hand can fix that. So you had all kinds of things creeping in. Said, where did that come from? Now, the apostles could lay hands on individuals and give them miraculous gifts, but they never forgave sins. And they never made that which was wrong right or that which was right wrong. They only had the ability to give gifts. And that was done by means of the Spirit's action. So all of these are issues that develop in the early church in the opening century. So there's another thing that develops in this idea of the influence of the authority of the bishops, assuming that they were apostolically connected. And if they were apostolically connected and had the authority of the apostles, what they said goes as if it came from God. Now, there are some people today who claim, quote-unquote, apostolic succession. And you'll find people in all kinds of different religious groups, some big, some little, who assume that they have equal authority to the apostles. And they will use that kind of name. Well, there's no indication of that absolutely whatsoever in the context of the New Testament. So that became an issue. And so over time, they would often refer to the church in Rome as the great church, because it was larger than any other church, and because it was at the center of the Roman Empire where the emperor lived and where all the officials lived and whatever. So the church in Rome over time became known as the great church because of where it was in the Roman Empire and because of its size. And so somehow or another, that kind of idea lent itself to saying, we got authority that you don't have. And our people have authority that your people don't have. And so this is centuries later. It's going to develop when people say, you have no right to call yourself the universal head of the church. I'm part of the church at Rome. This has been the great church since way back, and we have more authority. And so people started looking to Rome for guidance. Again, these things came incrementally. Reminder, a few classes ago, we talked about Paul meeting the elders of Ephesus in Miletus. And he did several things. He said, I've not shown to declare to you the whole counsel of God, but I've taught you the truth both publicly from house to house. He says, you'll probably never see me again. I'm going to the city of Jerusalem, and it's been prophesied I'm going to be bound. I'm going even if I'm going to die. So nothing's going to stop him. He says, let me tell you about stuff that's going to happen. You need to be aware of what's going to happen at the church. And he says, you need to also be aware of what's going to happen among you. Grievous error shall creep in from among you, referring to elders. And so within the first century or so, all kinds of stuff about quote-unquote church leadership goes haywire. Where did that stuff come from? It's interesting, in the midst of some of this, you know, there's some people saying, hey, that's not what Paul said about elders. And people said, you know, whatever, we've got the same authority that Paul does, so don't worry about that. All right, we're going to take a break in just a few minutes. The last part of the chapter I don't want to get into, but there's a whole issue about why in the world was there not any art that developed in the quote-unquote Christian church until almost the year 200. Now, after that, there's some other errors that are interesting. And I don't think this is on all the slides. But if you have, let's see if I can find that passage in there. There are about four or five reasons that they mentioned as to why art. Here we go. On page 167, and you don't have this, but I'll read this very quickly. There was an opposition to art in the early churches. Where did that come from? Number one, the Jewish aversion to images based on what the law said. Don't make any graven image. So they didn't just make an image, not to make an image. They didn't even make an image of an image. So they didn't make things that they said, this is God. They didn't even draw a picture of something that somebody else would say was God. So there seems to be an aversion to what started in Old Testament practices not to do so. Number two, to Christianity being a spiritual religion was antithetical, that is opposed to material manifestations. And so the whole concept of iconography and so forth, they weren't involved in that. Every Christian didn't come up out of the waters of baptism and somebody handed them a cross. You know, that doesn't come till later. You know, the development of those kind of things. So they're antithetical to material manifestations. Number three, Christian opposition to a pagan culture that was all over the top involved in visual imagery. So we don't want to be a part of that. And then four, some people have assumed that, well, they were just mostly poor people and they didn't have wherewithal to do that sort of thing. And so there is no quote-unquote real development of Christian art, as it were, until about 200. So this is like 110, 120 years after the close of the New Testament. Now what's interesting is religious art becomes a means of teaching almost as much as literature. Up to this point, everything that people knew about Christianity came from what was written. But now we learn things based upon what people drew. Right? There's no you know, smartphones that you'd snap a picture of anything. And some of the pictures may have been crude, you know, and drawn under at least, not the best of circumstances. But over a period of time, in the 3rd and 4th centuries, paintings started and all sorts of other images and carvings and so forth became developed as well. And that's another apostasy. I don't want to get into that. Somebody claimed to be an apostle. Why? So we've gone through just about a third of that book. And we have seen, as I mentioned before, that a lot of stuff happens after the close of the New Testament that gets away from the New Testament. And why did that happen? Because people weren't emphasizing stick with the New Testament. Remember when Joshua died? When Joshua died, the opening verses of Judges chapter 2, it says there arose another generation who didn't know God or the things that God had done for Israel. And it said, while Joshua was alive and those who were his contemporaries were alive, everything was okay. And so a generation developed who wasn't aware of what had been done before. It's interesting, when Gideon was called to be a judge, one of the things that Gideon said, and there's a legitimate basis for why he said that, he says, I want to know where the God is who used to take care of Israel like he did during the wilderness. He said, I don't see God doing miraculous things for us anymore. I don't see him feeding us with manna. I don't see him vanquishing our enemies. I want to know where that God is. Well, God didn't do the same stuff the same way he did for the people that was in then. And so some people lost faith. And so teaching was central to keeping people faithful. And when the teaching fails, the people will fail. And that's going to happen over and over and over. What we're going to do after we take a break is to focus more on principles of New Testament Christianity that we can find root and confidence in. And so we'll do that after the break. So let's break to about 7:30, and then we'll come back and deal with that at the end of the break. All right, thank you.